business.
The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Another exciting episode of the Linux Link Tech Show. This is episode 237. Tonight is Wednesday, March 19th. Welcome, everybody, to the show.
Hello, hello.
Hey, hey,
hey, everybody.
We got a fantastic guest. We've got Peter Semmelhack, the founder and CEO of Bug Labs. Peter, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
We're also talking to somebody else, though, too. You didn't know that, did you, Pat?
We got a secret guest?
No. Now I can't remember.
Mershad, actually, I don't think he's like... I'm not sure he's on the line right now anymore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm here, guys. How you doing, guys?
All right, there.
How you doing? All right, so
good.
Excellent. So let's roll right with it, Pat. Go ahead.
Peter, just give us a rundown of what Bug Labs is and what you guys are doing.
Sure. Bug Labs, you know, in the words of Rafe Needleman from CNET, called us the Lego of gadgets, which I thought was an interesting way to describe it, at least for the hardware side of things. What we're trying to do is we're trying to bring all of the sort of interesting and great principles of open source software to the hardware world to let people, really innovate, create hardware mashups as easily as they can create software mashups by having a platform that's sort of a modular-based set of electronics that you can mix and match like Legos and build any device you want.
That's pretty cool. Now, you guys had like a big unveiling at CES back, was it January? And, quite a buzz over there.
Yeah, you know, it was funny. We went to the show with a little six-foot booth. We didn't think we were going to get too much attention other than just from the real early adopters and techies of the world. But we really got an avalanche of attention. And I'd like to think it's because, you know, of this great little device we have. But I think more than that, it was because we really, I think we touched a nerve with respect to, openness and open source principles, not just existing in software, but also now coming to hardware. And what does that mean? And I think a lot of people were very intrigued by that. So that, I think, got us a sort of a snowball building, and we ended up winning the award. It was pretty astonishing.
What does that mean, the open source world?
Open source hardware?
Yes.
Well, it's a great question because it means different things to different people. Open source software is sort of simple because what it really refers to is source code. Open source hardware depends on what you do. If you are an engineer, an electrical engineer, then open source hardware to you may mean the schematic or the Gerber file, which defines the PCB board layout. If you are an industrial designer, then open source hardware to you might be the CAD files, which are open and so on. If you are just a manufacturer looking at stuff, maybe you're interested in the BOM. So, you know, depending on your frame of reference, it means different things. But for us, it means we're really more interested in the spirit of the approach versus the actual letters of the specific licenses, the GPL, the Creative Commons, whatever we're using. It's really just we want to provide to our end users, customers, the exact same types of freedoms that are given in the software world, meaning when you buy a product from us, you get all of the rights and licenses to hack it, to play with it, to do all kinds of new things with that without having to get approval from us or anyone else.
So we don't have to worry about the TiVoization of Bug Labs.
That's correct.
And that is awesome. Now, let me ask you a question. Were you guys on the Linux World Linux Cast a few months back?
I believe we might have been. I don't know off the top of my head. Rashad might know.
We were actually interviewed by Don Marty for a podcast a while back. Yeah.
Okay, that's what I thought. Okay, I thought that was you guys. So, I know I learned some really cool things from that interview that you did, but you know, maybe you could rehash for those people who haven't listened. What was the impetus for starting Bug Labs? I mean, what brought that about?
Sure. I really started the company because I just want, myself personally, I want the product we're building. So it's sort of a classic case of scratching my own personal itch. I really was frustrated by the fact that I couldn't easily build gadgets that I wanted. I initially wanted a wireless GPS, like a fully programmable wireless GPS device, which I couldn't find anywhere. In fact, you still can't really find them. Then I wanted, you know, a motion-controlled wireless camera. I wanted all kinds of things that, you know, I couldn't find at all. And if I did find them, they were many, many thousands of dollars. And it just came to me that, you know, Lego is a greater way to build physical things because it's a defined physical interface. It's intuitive. It's fun. And I sort of said to myself, why can't you bring that same sort of building methodology to electronics where you can have one Lego block GPS, one Lego block, which is a wireless modem of some kind, just snap them together and have it work. And I found out there's nothing like that out there. There's no technical reason you couldn't do it. And so we raised some venture capital, and here we are.
Now, you guys have the basic kit, which I see you have an early adopter price of $299. And what comes with the base unit?
The base unit is really a general purpose, like sort of small general purpose Linux computer. And in that device is a bunch of horsepower in the form of a MX31 by Freescale. It's 128 megabytes of RAM. It's a 532 megahertz processor, by the way. And the processor has like a floating point unit in it, a bunch of codecs. It's basically a multimedia processor. So there's a lot of cool things you could just do with the base unit just by itself. But it also has a number of other things on it that have to do with powering up different modules and so on. You can snap up to four different bug modules into it. It has Ethernet, USB, serial, I2C, I2S, UART, GPIO, all those interfaces are supported. So it really is the hub of all of the things that go on with Bug. It's sort of the brain of the whole experience. And then you snap modules into it. We're launching with four modules, which is the LCD screen, the GPS, the camera, and the motion detector / accelerometer. But then we have about 10 more modules in the pipe that are coming down, like a keyboard, a full-screen LCD, or full-size LCD, you know, barcode scanners, and audio ins and outs, video ins and outs, and so on. So, you know, really just getting started in terms of laying out what we want to do, but the Bug base is the anchor point.
I want to know what the teleporter module that's coming out in the second quarter of 2008.
It's going to be delayed, I think. We some problems with it. I think right around now we need an alien visitation or something to make it happen.
Once it's developed, we'll send it back in time once it's developed. So.
Is that with the time machine module?
Yeah, the time shifter. That's also, we're experiencing some difficulty, but I think we'll get over that.
Now, I see that the base model has an MPEG-4 hardware encoder and decoder. What are some of the other multimedia codecs that it'll support?
It does audio. You know, you're catching me off guard. I don't really know off the top of my head what all the different codecs would be, but I do know that one of the reasons we chose the processor is because it has all kinds of fun stuff in it for people to play with. So, you know, you can render MP3s automatically. You can do video all within that one chip. There's not a lot of, you know, outboard circuitry required to do a lot of the things that people want. The chip was originally designed, you know, I think for sort of smartphones. And you think what smartphones are able to do, which is voice, data, video, pictures, and so on. That's all that capability is built into the device.
Pretty interesting. Go ahead, Dan.
Oh, I was going to say, so your main focus for these right now is, it seems to be with multimedia, graphics, video, and display, as opposed to maybe what some other devices like the gum sticks tend more towards server applications.
Well, I would argue that we're not really looking for I'm really targeting any specific vertical. I mean, we just were talking about multimedia, but that's just sort of one area that the processor would be good at. I've got plenty of use cases that have to do with things like home automation and open source DVRs and, you know, GPS-enabled laser rangefinders, you know, things that don't really have anything to do with multimedia per se, but take advantage of the modular nature of the hardware platform, and also the integrated development environment and so on. So I would say certainly multimedia applications are an area of interest, as is gaming and so on, but that's really not the focus of the company.
Now, I see the current model doesn't support Wi-Fi, but I guess there's plans in the future to maybe include that at some point?
Yeah, the Wi-Fi is going to come as an actual module, and it's going to be a Wi-Fi and Bluetooth module combined. Later in the year, we're going to have a base which has both of those built into it. And the reason we had to wait a little bit is because the open source drivers weren't really available when we did the first rev, and because we wanted to, you know, stick to our principles of open source and having it be 100% open source, we really wanted to use everything with the GPL based license. So those drivers actually came from Intel not too long ago, and we're now revving the board to include Wi-Fi. Should come out later this year.
Now I'm looking at the board here, and just curious, where is the Ethernet? Does it have an Ethernet jack on it?
Yeah, there's a connector on the back called a Handy Link, which is not a proprietary. It's just a standard. And HandyLink has Ethernet serial and power, and so there's a cable that exposes an RJ45 and a serial connector and the power jack. So you just plug that cable in, and you get your normal Ethernet connector.
Now, sticking with the open source philosophy, what has it taken to get the manufacturers of these chipsets and everything to be forthcoming with what you need to write drivers, or were they willing to write the drivers themselves?
Well, the chipsets, I mean, everything we've used for the most part with respect to drivers in the Linux kernel are all open source. We're not open sourcing the designs of the chips or anything like that. I mean, the firmware on the chips is the firmware on the chips. We're not saying that we're open sourcing any of that, because we don't really have access to that. And frankly, I don't know how valuable that would be anyway to our particular target audience. But from the Linux kernel up, everything from that point forward is all totally open source.
Well,
go ahead.
When you guys were assembling this device, was it difficult to find chipsets or whatever it is you needed that would be compatible and have open drivers, or did you have to haggle with the vendors, the manufacturers of these devices to provide specs so the drivers could be written?
It was a huge hassle because for the most part, in the sort of embedded world, open source is just becoming a force to be reckoned with. For the longest time, it was always a very, very locked down proprietary world. And so on the one hand, you know, vendors would come up with open source drivers. They would say they have open source drivers to satisfy sort of the marketing need of saying they have them. But then when you get into it, you start looking at them closely, they're really not very well written, not very well supported or updated. So you ended up working with stuff like that, which took a long time to get through and redo. And in some cases, we had to write our own for devices that didn't have any drivers at all for Linux. So that took a big chunk of time and effort on our side. So, yeah, it was a hassle. By no means are we in a situation in the embedded world where, you know, there are high-quality open-source drivers for anything you want are available. I think, you know, 5-10 years from now we'll be there, but right now it's still pretty early sledding.
Now, you guys are going with an Eclipse-based plugin for the development environment, right?
Yep.
And I guess the primary...
Right?
Dragonfly, right?
Yep.
And it's primarily the main environment's what? It's Java-based, right?
Right now the development environment focuses on Java. One, we really like the idea that write once, run anywhere. I think it's a great model. Very much suits what we're doing. but it also comes with a lot of frameworks that are very, very useful, not only for the consumer space, but for the enterprise, right? So we have, I think, a big opportunity, not just in the consumer space, but with companies who want to use this in interesting ways, having a Java framework, and not J2ME, but like the real Java stack, gives them some comfort that they can do what they need to do in a much more sophisticated way on the device. And I think that's, you know, it's a good place to start. That said, we have a number of plugins that we're developing that will allow you to do scripting like Python and Ruby and others, as well as, because of the fact that it's just Eclipse, there are C-based plugins for that you can use as well to hack away at the bug. But from our standpoint, we're starting with Java, and we hope people recognize that, you know, with that comes a lot of benefits, and we'll see. But so far, so good.
And yeah, I guess the biggest challenge, I guess, with any kind of embedded device like this is building up a community user base for people to hack on. What kind of response have you guys gotten regarding the whole environment and everything?
On the whole, I think we've gotten a tremendous response just by virtue of the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, the press has picked this up, so we've got, you know, some good buzz. In terms of the actual community, even though we haven't really started, we just actually started shipping hardware, but prior to Monday, we had no hardware available to anybody. It was really a SDK-only type of community. We have, I think, 750 or so community members who are actively part of building applications and participating in the forums and so on. So it's a great start. By next year, we hope it to be 10 times bigger. But, you know, the people who are interested in this now are really sort of the hardcore, folks who really want to get into what we're doing and do some new stuff and do it first. So we're very, very pleased with the response so far. And stay tuned, because we're going to come up with a lot of new programs that are coming out that are specifically geared towards promoting what we're doing and recognizing the efforts of the guys and gals in the community.
Well, what are some of the applications that you guys have targeted out of the box, at least in the
We're not targeting, but not really targeting anything. We're really waiting on the community to do it. And there are some funny ones out there. There's one called the GPS alarm clock, which is an alarm clock or an alarm that goes off when you get to a certain location. And the person who came up with it did it because they were always sleeping through their train stop, and they wanted a device that would just go off and wake them up as they got close to their train stop. And I thought that was a very very simple but very useful application. There was another one that was written, spoken about, which I thought also was awesome, which was he wanted to have a base, bug base, with a GPS, a 3G modem, and a radar detector. And he wanted to leave it in his car, and he wanted to get all of his friends to do this too, because as they detected radar from police cruisers, they would post the position on the map somewhere, like a Google map, so that anyone else who cared to look would know where the police are. And that was kind of a funny app. You're not going to go to Radio Shack and buy that device anytime soon. These are some of the offbeat ones. We have plenty of other ones that are business related, sort of like fleet management, manufacturing, assembly line automation, agricultural irrigation types of applications. I mentioned home automation before. You know, what's nice about the position that we're in as a platform is it sort of encourages people to think in new ways and to feel the freedom of a platform that doesn't restrict them with crazy transaction costs and royalties and weird licenses. It's just, you know, have at it and make it your own.
Now, if somebody starts playing around with the modules like the GPS, I mean, in kind of like in a nutshell, if they're interested in doing something like, you know, just a simple GPS they throw on the dashboard or wherever they're going that maps out where they are, I mean, what skill level would they have to have with regards to programming, and how difficult would it be to get like the maps and everything for that?
So if you look at it from the standpoint of programming skill, out of the gate you need Java without any question. And that's have a new editor, which is a more of a WYSIWYG kind of editor with drag and drop modules in it, so you can drag lines between them to indicate inputs and outputs. But that's not available right now. But, that said, getting, you know, interacting with the GPS and getting data from that and then mashing it up with, say, a Google map or something like that is not complicated at all. We provide within Dragonfly lots of templates and sort of shortcuts so that all you have to do is from within a wizard say, you know, I want to build an application and I want to use these services, one of which is a GPS. You say that, it'll automatically put in all the framework code to speak to the device, and all you have to do then put is your application logic. So we try to make it really easy. In fact, one of the things we were doing at CES was building applications on shop floor as people requested them, which I thought was pretty neat. So our hope is that, you know, out of the gate, Java developers and others who are interested can very easily build applications and share them with others. But again, over time, I think the barriers are going to come down, and it's not going to be quite so hard. You mentioned maps. I think that when you're talking mapping, we usually think about it in terms of going and mashing up lat-long data with Google Maps. If you're asking whether or not there's maps available for the bug in respect to like a map kit, what have you, that's not something we're going to provide, but it may be something that's available elsewhere that you can just use.
Now, you had said when we were talking about the base module and its multimedia capability that it has the ability to output MP3 and it has an MPEG hardware encoding
yep.
and decoding. Now, do you end up in a gray area with regards to licensing of any software or anything that would need to be utilized by this device to be able to do anything with the MPEG codecs? Is that covered by the processor?
I don't believe so. Yeah, it's just all under the processor. I don't think there's any special licensing fees that we need to actually, you know, do anything specific. I think when we buy the processor from Freescale, it includes a royalty payment of some kind to somebody, so I think that's probably how it's handled.
So how many, when you first designed this, is this the basic design that you've had since the beginning of this device, or has it gone through various changes?
I did a proof of concept type thing, which is really me literally hacking stuff together with a plexiglass case, which looks pretty much like a hack with a plexiglass case. So this is a result of a year and a half design effort with a very well-respected design firm here in New York. It's professionally designed, but this is the first iteration of the design for sure. It's just going to get a little svelter, a little sexier over the next year or so. But the basic DNA of the design is sort of much set. Based on the idea that you snap modules into this thing. The islands on top and bottom are configured in such a way that you can slide accessories into them or slide the base into something else. So there's lots of ideas around that. But, the base design is set, and we'll just tweak it from here.
So is it possible to connect multiple bases together so that you can utilize more than four devices? Or modules?
Yeah, we're going to be coming out with these things called mechanical modules that really just sort of, they don't have any electrical capability. They just connect bases together so you can do what you just said. And then you connect them together with Ethernet, and you can actually have some multitasking going on between them over the Ethernet bus. We're not going to be doing a lot of support of that type of activity ourselves directly, but we anticipate the community doing some interesting things in that respect.
Well, in line with that, then, is there a limitation to the number of modules that you can connect into a single base station other than the physical four slots that are on it? I mean, could you get, like, an extension widget?
Sure. Yeah, logically, there's no limit. There's no logical limit. It's just physical. So if you got the equivalent of an octopus, then you clicked it into one of the connectors, and it had... it somehow allowed you to connect 20 modules to it and power it appropriately, then absolutely. The processor and the application framework can handle hundreds, thousands of inputs. It's really based on, what the data looks like and what you want to do with it.
So what do those modules connect into? That's not USB, right? What type of bus is that?
Well, it's a connector called a Samtec connector. It's a 40-pin connector. It's not proprietary. It's owned by a company called Samtec. You can buy it from DigiKey. And we took the low sort of brute force method of connecting to the CPU, which is we basically just we expose every interface that the CPU has on a different set of pins within that connector. So if you've got a USB-based module and you plug it in, well, then the only pins that are sort of alive are the few that have to do with USB. If you plug in a device which is a serial-based device, then it only, you know, pays attention to the pins that have to do with serial interface. So we standardize on this connector because it's just a well-known, very reliable, good connector, but then we talk through it based on the pinouts for the different interface we're thinking about. So that's how that connector works. And as I think I mentioned earlier, that we support USB, UR, GPIO, I2C, I2S, and so on. Basically, every interface that the processor has comes up through those pins. But then on the back of the unit, we have mini USB, we have the Ethernet and serial. There's a micro card there. So, we're trying to sort of provide as many possible interfaces as we can in a convenient form factor.
So then, when you say it's open hardware, is the person able to easily like disassemble this device and look at what makes it tick, or sure. Is it more solid state?
Well, I mean, it's a solid state device, of course, but there are screws that are easily accessible that you can unscrew the device and and we make it fairly simple. You can replace the battery. You can get at it very easily, and that was the whole spirit of the design, was that we don't want it to be like an iPhone where, trying to figure out how to open it requires a PhD. It's really just take the thing apart and play with it.
Now, why not lock it up? I mean, you got a sweet device there. You could lock it all up and control the keys and make a ton of money,
huh? Well, we think that maybe you can in the short term, but for us, we're really all about changing how innovation happens in the consumer electronics world, and it's more of a bottoms-up approach versus a top-down, and I think that's the way of the future, frankly. I don't think that it'd be hard to build a company that looks just like Apple today, because I think most people would agree that the business model that's wrapped around, closed proprietary architectures and hard lock-in of end users, it's just hard to build a company around that. It's hard to raise money with a company like that. You're going to compete against companies that are like that is with openness. And we firmly believe that that's the sort of the model of the future, and that's why we're doing it.
And speaking of, like, iPhone capability, do you foresee, like, cell phone modules coming out for this device?
Sure. I think what's going to happen first, though, is we're going to come out with a data modem that you'll be able to do Skype over. That's probably going to be the shortest distance to getting voice on the device. But, we could come up with a module that supports voice, but then the real question, at least in this country, is going to be getting certified on the network.
That's true.
We'll have to port over an Asterisk client, Dan.
There you go. An Asterisk server.
Yeah, that'd be good, too. I think in other countries it'll be easier because it just requires a SIM card. A modem that works, and then a SIM card. But in this country, which is where we're focused right now, it's a multi-month effort to get any kind of certification if you, in fact, ever get it.
You gotta get approval from the FCC, no?
No, we don't, because we're not making the modem. We're buying an FCC-approved modem. What has to be approved is the antenna, which may have an FCC. That probably does have an FCC component.
So I'm looking at your modules that you have to click into this device right now. If we could just quickly talk about those and exactly what they do. What is the bug locate? Is that
the GPS device? It's I think it's a NavMan chipset, very, very sensitive, and really that's basically what it is. It's just a chip on a board that fits into the bug base and communicates over our bus to the development environment so that you can use web services to interact with it. But you know, every module really has a discrete function. So GPS locate is, bug locate is a GPS device, GPS chip set.
And then the Bugcam 2MP, that would be basic camera?
It's a 2-megapixel camera, yeah.
Two megapixel camera, and then you have, of course, the BugView, which is an LCD display.
Yep. It's a full-color touchscreen LCD. It's the same LCD as in the video iPod. So it's a very high quality component.
So now the one that's coming out in the second quarter, the touch-sensitive color LCD, is going to be roughly twice the size of the current one?
Yes. It'll be as close as we can get to the sort of the physical dimensions of the base unit.
And then finally you have the Bug Motion, which I assume is some kind of motion detection?
Yeah, it's a motion detector, and also there's an accelerometer built into it. And what's nice about that is it's actually it's a pretty high-quality accelerometer with the ability to do, play with gestures and so on, so you can build a game controller with the device. I think we're going to have a lot of fun with that. I also want to point out one that you may or may not see on the list you have, which is our Von Hippel module. The Von Hippel module, which is named after an MIT professor named Eric Von Hippel, who was a close friend of ours and sort of a mentor in respect to open source hardware. It was his idea, and basically what it is it's a breakout box or breakout module for all the interfaces that the base has, so you can build your own module very easily.
That's neat. Now, is that Von Hippel module for sale now?
Nope. We're going to announce availability in the next week or so. But it'll be coming out soon, and it'll be hopefully a great catalyst for all kinds of new things.
That's just so neat looking. I mean, that whole little device there, you could get the whole bug bundle all one shot.
Yeah. It is kind of fun. Every once in a while I forget about the device because I'm so busy doing other things, and I pick this up and I go, hey, this thing's kind of cool.
It kind of looks like, it looks aesthetically pleasing too. I mean, it's just, it's shiny. It almost looks too nice to be so geeky.
Well, yeah, one of the things we're hoping is that people really hack it up. Like my own personal one, I have, I've marked it up with, stickers and magic markers. And it's like, it sort of looks like a device that has gotten a lot of use. And one of the reasons we made it white is we kind of saw it as a canvas for people to play with, and they can add, whatever they want to it. And we're hoping people personalize them in ways that's interesting and fun. And for those who don't, it looks nice.
So what do you do with yours?
I like to use mine as a GPS. It's a what I like about the fact is that it's totally programmable. There's a great example of an example use of that. I was at CES and a guy comes up and obviously not a geek. He's dressed in a suit, looked nice. And he's like, "Hey, I was overhearing what you're talking about, and I really want one of these things." And I said, "Wow, cool. What do you have in mind?" He said, "Well, I'm an account manager for some company, and I spend most of my time in the car. I've got a great car. It's got a great GPS in it, but it doesn't do something really critical, which it doesn't keep track of where I go, and it doesn't have a log. And I need that log so at the end of the year I can submit it for my taxes and get my non-reimbursed business expense deduction." And he said, "What you're telling me is that this GPS you have here, you can program it." And I said, "Yeah, we can program it. In fact, we'll do it right now." And we programmed it on the shop floor, and that program became something called GPS Traveler, which is now available in our community. But it was an example of, if you take the word programming or programmable and you stick it in front of any device that you know today, it kind of changes the value of it. So, I can't program my Garmin or my Magellan or my TomTom or anything, but if I slap a GPS onto a Linux computer, well, now I can. And this wasn't a guy who was interested in hacking anything. He just wanted that application. And so that, to me, is a very, very valuable configuration because you can do all kinds of fun stuff with it.
It's such an awesome technology you have going on there.
Thank you. We're really happy with it.
Now, I assume, you know, based upon winning at, was it CNET? No.
CNET, CES.
Yeah, and I mean, how has the response been from the community, people, like, snatching these things up? Has it been, you know, have you been pleased with how well they're selling?
I have been, and we didn't really have high expectations to begin with, so we're not selling, you know, tens of thousands of them, but I feel like we are, we're approaching a community that is very interested in what we're doing. We have, you know, we're a brand new company, and I think there's some sort of, you know, show me what you got right now in the market, because we have never shipped anything before. We're starting to ship it now. We're going to start seeing people doing interesting things. So, but, you know, that said, I've been very gratified with the response we've gotten. You know, it's a great starting point. We're going to be, by the end of the year, hopefully hitting some big numbers. And big for us, again, is not hundreds of thousands. You know, it's much lower than that. You know, we have a long-term view of this. We really don't think that this is going to be, you know, next year's, you know, iPod or anything. It's really, we really want to seed the market, get a lot of innovative stuff going on in different areas, and just sort of, you know, grow the garden, if you will. You know, one of the reasons, you know, we have the SDK, which is another thing which we've been happy with the hardware sales, but we've been very, very happy with the number of downloads we've gotten. You know, the SDK, which we call Dragonfly, is available for free on our website. Anyone can go and download it and play with it. There's an emulator built into it, so you can start playing with, you know, hardware, quote, hardware, even if you don't have the device. So that's a big benefit, and that's all the, you know, most of the applications written today have been written using that emulator. So, you know, the response has been terrific. And insofar as we can sort of predict the future, I really feel as if once a lot more people get the actual hardware in their hands, you're going to see a lot more interesting things happen.
I guess what really, really stands out in my mind when I see the Bug Labs kit is that it seems you guys have really made a finished product, where other embedded devices, the kits that they sell, are just, you know, cards with connectors and everything. You guys kind of want to, like, take that away and just make it, you know, this is a little box, you snap it into this box, and you try to get people to concentrate on what the end result is instead of, you know, getting down to the nitty-gritty as far as the hardware.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we're not trying to take anything away from the existing vendors who are providing component and component-level things, because there's a market for that. What we're trying to address is sort of one level above that. People who, frankly, are like me, who, you know, I don't really want to get into the solid-state electronics side of things. I really just want a device. I know what features I want, and I want to just be able to build it in seconds. You know, like, just, I don't want to have to do serial protocol communication programming. I want to just snap it together and have it work, and then be able to program it. And I think there's a market for that, and I think that's primarily where we're focused, and that required a more of a product, finished product type of approach.
It's just, wow.
I'm installing the development kit right now.
Are you going to get one, Pat?
Maybe. I might have to ask for it for my birthday.
There you go.
When's your birthday?
Not till the summertime.
They need you to buy one now.
Well, let me download the development kit and play around for a bit.
So what's your background with regards to development and all this? I mean, are you an electrical engineer?
No, my entire background actually is in software. The company I founded prior to Bug was a company called Antenna Software, which is a mobile enterprise software company that focuses on basically corporate clients who want to use wireless devices like BlackBerries and Treos and so on to get access to their back-end data systems. So I've never done a hardware device in my life, but on the other hand, one of the things that I do know is that I think that, you know, hidden in many software developers is a frustrated hardware developer. Because one of the things that I sort of realized was that, you know, I've been trained since college that the target of my software development is defined by somebody else. It really revolves around a screen, a keyboard, and a mouse. And that's what you designed applications for. Now what we're saying is, you know, as a software developer, you can now design the target at the same time you're designing the application. So that opens up an enormous level of freedom that in the past wasn't really available. You had to sort of pick your platform and design for it. And if your application really could have used a camera, but the platform you're choosing doesn't have one, well, then you can't do anything about it. This is a sort of a fascinating new development for software developers, because now it's this whole new vector that they can sort of pursue. And so my background, I think, just is an interesting profile of who our target audience is. Certainly the hardware hackers and so on are going to like what we're doing, but I think what will be more intriguing are the folks that we can get who have no hardware hacking experience at all, but are interested in building devices and playing with devices in a way they haven't been able to in the past.
So it's almost like an intro embedded Linux device for people.
It can be, yeah. But the thing is that you don't even have to care if it's Linux. Like, if you really just want to put devices together, it could be running, an IBM operating system. It's a box that does what it's supposed to do, which is respond to modules that get plugged in and so on. If you do want to hack down to the Linux level, we have all kinds of documentation on our wiki for how to do that, and to recompile the kernel and add devices, and all that kind of stuff is there. But it's not necessary to have fun with the product.
Now, this a product like this would be great in the educational area. Have you guys looked into maybe working with some of the colleges or universities or even high schools to come up with some kind of a educational program to embed a device?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. It's a great lead question, because next week we're announcing a program called our EDU program. And what it really is it's a set of programs that make it easy for schools and universities to get hardware for low cost, if not no cost, based on an application that they submit telling us what they want to do, various discounts and so on. We didn't have to go looking to educational sort of institutions. They've found us, because I think most people recognize that this is an interesting tool for teaching and for exploring new things. And so I've had many, many conversations with various individuals and organizations to get this in the hands of their students quickly. Realistically, we're not going to probably start moving much volume until the fall, when school starts to kick in again. But the programs are in place now, and we're going to be having I think lots of interesting conversations over the next few months, and we're very excited about the direction.
Now, as far as resources for developers, what do you guys have out there? You have a wiki, some forums, what else?
Yeah, we got a wiki, which is very, very comprehensive. All kinds of great stuff there. We have forums that are active every single day. There's lots of guys in there, asking questions and responding to one another. We have downloads of the latest builds, as we build them. It could be even on a daily basis. You'll see that listed on the website. Let's see, what else? The wiki is really the big one in terms of resources that we provide and that the community can also add to, and then the forums.
Well, I got the development kit installed already, and looks interesting. I see you guys got some basic demo applications in there.
Yeah.
Some tutorials.
We got a bunch of stuff in there. I think the thing I want to just plug, if I could, is that we have a contest going on now. If anyone's listening is interested in, if they have the SDK or what have you, it's a contest that has to that asks, give us your best ideas for new modules, give us your best idea for applications. Popular Science magazine is sponsoring it, and it ends on the 1st of April, and winners are going to get free bug hardware. So if you download the SDK like you just did, and you have some great ideas for applications, it may be worth your time to submit them to the Popular Science website and maybe get your hardware that way.
Cool. Are you guys submitting any projects for the Google Summer Code or no?
No, not this year. I think next year we're going to do that.
I'm definitely going to be checking this stuff out. It looks interesting.
Well, I appreciate that, and would love your feedback as well.
The plugin looks nice, the Eclipse plugin.
Thank you. Yeah, we've been working hard on that. And, again, it's open source, so if you've got any good ideas, have at it and share them, because one of the things we're really trying to do is get the community to participate in not only just the consumption of what we're doing, but in the development of it.
I see some of the basic applications people have listed.
Yeah.
Security camera, GPS, weather.
Yep. There's a number.
The possibilities are pretty wide open, what you could do, I mean.
Yeah. Well, that's what we hope. You know, we're really just trying to provide, like, the 2x4s, nails, hammers, and saws for, you know, people to go and build stuff.
Now, as far as documentation, you know, you touched a little bit about the developer resources. Is there anything more formal, say, like books or, you know, the manual per se?
No, really, we're trying to keep paper to a minimum. There's a, you know, it's a quick start guide and that kind of thing, but I'd love to say that we've written manuals, or, you know, Riley has a whole series on us, but not yet. Someday soon, but not yet.
That's for us to do, right?
Yeah.
Do you have an idea how big the initial developer base is? Do you have numbers? How many people have downloaded?
I think I would argue that our target audience in the United States is between 3 and 5 million. You know, if you take a small percentage of that, say 1 or 2% of that, you get 100,000. Users, that's kind of where we're probably going to be targeting.
As far as the SDK, how many people have downloaded it already, do you know?
You know, I don't have that number at the top of my head, but it's been in the thousands.
It looks really awesome. I'm just checking it out, and it looks interesting.
You know, one of the things to keep in mind, too, is the community we're engaging is not just for applications. We're also soliciting ideas for modules. You know, we have our own sort of product development plan, which includes a little over 80 different modules that have to do with everything from inputs, outputs, and sensors and actuators and all that kind of stuff. But we're trying to encourage people to give us their ideas for modules as well, because... You know, clearly we don't have all the ideas. We probably don't even have most of the good ideas. We just are trying to show the market what we have in mind. And because one of the things we want to try to do is get people to not only nominate module ideas, but then help us bring them to market by collecting other people who would say they want them. And, you know, if we get a certain number of people who are interested in it, we'll go build it. So have it be a real conversation.
Now, as far as developer get-togethers and events, have you guys had anything?
We just had one actually at EclipseCon out on the West Coast, which Mershad was attending, which I think went pretty well. Mershad, what do you think? How many people? What was the attendance there?
It's kind of low key, but it was about 20 people, 25 people showed up, like a spur of the moment announcement. And every venue we go to, every city, every conference, we try to have a Bug Plus event where we invite members of the local development community, Java enthusiasts, open source advocates to just join us for a drink and, you know, talk tech, geek out.
You guys should do a roadshow, maybe some of the logs and Java user groups.
Yeah,
we're also going to be at a Log Radio event in San Francisco between, I believe, April 12th and 13th. But Peter and I have talked about the idea of just getting a party bus and going around the nation from city to city and just doing it that way. But I don't think we have it in the budget just yet.
Looks interesting. I definitely have to make it out to one of them. Probably New York if you have something in New York.
Well, we're going to be targeting universities, too, by having things there, you know, like hackathons and just special promotional events going on at universities. And I think that's going to be a great source of ideas and business for us.
Now, do you guys have an RC where people can get together and talk about development ideas or no?
Yep, absolutely. Bug Labs.
Was it on Freenode?
I believe so.
Yeah, it's on Freenode. Activity is kind of sparse right now, but you can join and just talk bug.
Cool. I have to pop in there and say hello.
Yeah, you should. I think there are people who monitor it, but you know, the community is not really big enough yet to have people constantly yakking on there, but soon.
Excellent. This really looks like really interesting stuff. Glad you guys, you know, are, you know, taking the initiative and going for it.
Well, thank you. Well, we're having a lot of fun. I think, you know, this time next year will be an interesting conversation to have and see how far we've come. But we are certainly having a lot of time, a lot of fun, and hopefully that results in some great product.
Excellent. Well, Peter, thanks for taking the time to talk to us. We really appreciate it. You guys are welcome to come back in the future. This looks like a real interesting product you guys are selling, and it looks like really a really interesting device to hack on. And,
we hope all of your listeners are interested in what we're up to, so I appreciate the time.
I'm definitely going to check it out.
Great.
Yeah, we've had, in the past, we've had some open, like, embedded people come on. We talked to the Gumsticks people, OpenMoco, a few other projects, and in a way, we're kind of wrapping up the embedded series, I guess, I was just saying.
I didn't know we had a series going.
Yeah, it kind of just wound up that way. You know, I just had different people on, you know, different embedded devices, you guys were the last ones we were doing, so. You get the final word, as you say.
Good. Well, listen, I really appreciate the opportunity to explain what we're up to, and you know, again, if you have any questions, you know, anybody can jump into the forums and participate. We look forward to seeing you guys somewhere in Bug's future.
Cool. Thanks for coming on. We appreciate it.
Yes,
all right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
That's a real neat device.
It's very cool.
I don't know anything about programming. Otherwise, it would be real. I'd be tempted to buy one.
Well, it's Java. You know, you can do. You know, with Eclipse, you can code together applications pretty quickly, even if you're not really that hardcore into it. And he was saying that they're looking to use to get Python on there too. So, Python's a pretty easy language to learn. I mean, and it's very powerful.
Yeah, I've never done anything in it, so. It's all new to me.
And it's really nice. I'm looking at the Eclipse plugin. Basically, with Eclipse, you know, there's a framework, and you can do all sorts of things with it. And most of the Eclipse stuff they do, they tend to use for development on IDE, mm-hmm. and a debugger. And it has a framework where you can create your own plugins where it's pretty straightforward and not that difficult to put together your own development environment depending on what you have, and that's what these guys have. And it's really powerful, and it's a fantastic piece of software.
Excuse me.
It's one of those things where, you know, you can twist it and turn it into anything you want to.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've used it for Java and a little bit of Python. There's a nice Python module called PyDev, and it's pretty cool. You can have all these different plugins, and it's very easy to switch going from one environment to the other. You just go in and change the perspective, and you're in it. Like right now, I'm in the Bug Labs development perspective, you know, their SDK, and
okay.
I can switch it real easy. And it's nice because it's cross-platform. I know a lot of people rag on Java, but it's free software, you know, so.
Yeah, I've never done anything in Java.
Some people hate it, you know. They say, oh, it's slow as hell. Yeah, the older versions were slow, you know, because it's using a... you know, with most modern software and programming languages, you have your source code, and then you compile it, and then you have your binary. Well, Java's a little different in that when you do a compile, you're not creating a pure binary. You're creating what's called bytecode. And what it is each platform has a virtual machine, you know, Linux on x86, Mac, Windows. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of the embedded devices now have Java virtual machines. And, you know, I guess the idea was, you know, write once and run everywhere.
Run everywhere, yeah.
That was the initial, you know, that was the promise. And, you know, you can code applications that do that, but sometimes you run into, you know, limitations of the hardware and the platform that you're running it on. And it might not be as fast as, obviously, you know, say C or C++, you know, native compiled binaries, you know, which just makes sense, you know, because mm-hmm. when you're running it in the virtual machine, it's interpreting the bytecode. So there's more overhead involved.
Yeah.
And they also have this idea of what's called just-in-time compilers, where you can almost, you know, say like you have your program, and you can use a just-in-time compiler and compile for a particular target platform.
Okay.
And your executable will be a lot quicker than just a generic bytecode that you have. You know, it that kind of goes against what the initial promise was, but I mean, there are some job applications.
What it turned into, though.
Yeah, they're kind of workarounds, and plus machines are getting much faster, more powerful, and there are some Java-based applications out there that are really powerful, like Azorius. Have you ever used Azorius, Alan, the BitTor client?
Oh, I've used it, yeah.
That's a pretty nice application. It's Java-based.
Yeah, that one I know. Although I haven't used it in a long time. I haven't done anything BitTor in a long time either, so.
Yeah. Eclipse is entirely developed with Java.
Now that I've never used. So.
Yeah, well, if you're not doing the software development, you probably won't have any experience with it. But it's not bad, you know. I've been doing Java programming on and off, you know, for a number of years now, and it's not a bad language, you know. Like with any language, you know, it's imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I haven't actually played around with .NET. Now, some people talk about .NET framework, and they say, yeah, that's Microsoft's answer to Java, you know, C# language.
Yeah, okay.
I haven't used that at all, so I couldn't tell you.
I guess I doubt I'll ever learn any of those. I stick to just the little bit of Bash that I know, and that's about it.
Well,
enough to get me in trouble.
You know, part of the story why Microsoft created the .NET framework and C# language, right? They had their own version of Java. It was called Visual J++.
Yeah, I remember reading about that.
The whole notion of embrace, extend, and extinguish, that was, you know, Microsoft mantra back in, like, the 90s. They were, you know, doing that wholeheartedly.
I think it still is their mantra. But
yeah, but it's not as bad.
It's just not as doing it
not
quite
as blatant.
As often. Yeah.
Well, they did that with Java. They basically created their own implementation of it in Visual J++. And they created a bunch of classes that were specific just to Microsoft's version. And they basically broke backward compatibility. And Sun didn't particularly like that, so they sued them.
I remember reading about that stuff, yeah.
And they actually won that lawsuit, I believe. So after they lost the lawsuit, Microsoft stopped anything to do with Java. So they created their own language and their own framework, and that's how .NET and C# came about.
Okay.
You know, I haven't used it per se, but I've read about it a little bit, and I've talked to some people who've coded it. Some people really like it. I mean, you know, Miguel Villacasa, he's doing his Mono thing, which is basically .NET for Linux.
Mm-hmm. Well, somebody must be using it.
I guess
so. They're forcing you to use it.
I guess so. Someone likes it. Someone's using it. Now, that goes into the whole that Silverlight thing. Have you looked at that at all?
I have read a little bit about it, but I haven't really looked at it.
Yeah, basically...
programming stuff, I try to get into it, and it just never really sinks in.
Yeah, basically, Silverlight was Microsoft's attempt to create a Flash killer. That's mm-hmm. what they're looking to do. And I think at first it's only Microsoft platform, but Miguel has extended it, you know, via Mono, and implemented with his own thing, Silverlight. Now, I don't know if anybody's actually used it. I haven't actually checked that out. And I think Dan was looking at it a little bit, and I don't think he had much success getting it to actually work. I know that all that basic development was done in SUSE and on SLED.
Yeah.
So I don't know how difficult it is to run that stuff in other Linux distributions.
Well, if Rick gets back, we can ask him.
Yeah.
Dan has disappeared from the show.
Yep.
We don't know what he's doing. As Pat put it, burning the mule.
Well, you know what that
is. Yeah, I know. I just have to admit that I've never actually heard called that before.
That's a pretty funny thing.
I have to remember that one, burning the mule.
Yep. Now, I posted a poll out on the forum today. And
yes, I saw that.
It's in regards to Apple. You know, I have issues with Apple.
Thank you for welcoming me.
Well, I didn't particularly say Alan. I didn't single you out, but basically,
actually, I think you put Link's name on there, right?
Yeah, Link's name is on there. Basically, the question is, should we call out the Apple lovers amongst our ranks? A lot of times when you go to Linux and open source conferences, you see a lot of people with MacBooks, you know, typing away on there, and it seems a lot of people like it. And Alan, you're an Apple user. You like Apple, don't you?
I use it. Yeah, it's another piece of technology to me. I'm very platform agnostic, I guess, with the exception of I don't like using Windows. But you know, I'll use whatever works for me. If it stops working, I'll stop using it. And right now, since I have an iPod, having the little Mac Mini works perfectly with it.
So let me ask you, let's talk about your Apple history. What was the first Mac that you actually owned?
The first Mac? Good night. I don't remember now. On it. An SE30. But actually, I got that relatively recently on it. My Mac stuff has all been very, very recent, actually. I think I picked up when we did that computer thing with the lug, I picked up two SE30s because I always wanted one of those, not because they do anything in particular. It's just because I really wanted one of those back when they were new on it, and picking them up for the $50 I got for the both of them was a good deal in my eyes. Well, let's see, what else did I have? Well, I picked up the message pad. Is that what it's called? I have to go look. I got to dig it up. The PDA that Mac put out years ago, or Apple put out years ago.
I have no idea.
Yeah. Now I can't remember. I don't remember where I put it to go look at the name. It was one of those little PDAs everybody made fun of because it had the handwriting recognition on it. And I found one at one of
the Newton?
Newton's, yeah, I'm sorry. Message pad was the second name of it, but it was a Newton. And I found a good deal for, I think I paid $20 for it, with the charger and the whole nine yards with it, some programs on it, at one of the computer fests.
So you're recent, and you've only been playing around.
Oh, yeah, I've always been recent on stuff. I mean, I had my start back with 8088s and stuff, you know. And Commodore 64 is just like the same as everybody else.
Do you purchase software for it?
For which?
For the Mac. Do you go out and buy like third-party applications, extra stuff, besides the base OS and I guess iLife suite that it comes with?
I bought one thing for the Mac, and that was, I don't know if you remember, about a year or 2 years ago on it, they were selling these little cameras at CVS, these little...
But those Apex?
Video cameras. Yeah, those little ones. And there was some hacks going around for it. And I had dug up the cables and stuff to make the hacks on it. And when I tried to play it through QuickTime, because it actually would play back in QuickTime on it, I was having problems playing it back. So I figured, well, gee, maybe I need to buy because QuickTime didn't have all of the codecs in it. So I paid $20 for the extra codecs only to find out that it didn't work anyways. But that's the only thing I've ever really bought for one. With open source wherever possible.
It gets expensive. I mean, yeah,
if you're buying all their stuff, yeah. But, you know, I mean, you can do everything. You know, there's open source versions of, you know, Office that you can put on there. All the things you need. You know, there's an X-Chat client for it. I mean, you really don't have to screw around with buying stuff unless you're one of those people who likes to buy things for it, right?
Because
shy of buying the hardware itself and whatever comes on it, that's where it stays for me.
It can get pretty damn expensive, you know, a little, you know, $15 there, $30 there, $50 there.
Well, you said I paid $20. That's the most I've said that, you know, I bought on that one. And that was because, you know, at the time I didn't realize I had other options to do. And I was just trying to get this one particular thing to work for me. I ended up playing, if I had downloaded VLC for it, and VLC played it fine.
So I guess my question is, you know, having, you know, people that are into Mac, you know, in the Linux community, is it a good thing, really?
I don't think it hurts at all. You know, most of the people, you know, I think most of the people like us who will run Macs won't be the ones going out.
Speak for yourself,
office.
My friend.
Well, no. I mean, you know, us in the community in general on it aren't going to be the people who are going to run out and buy the $300 version of Office for, you know, when we know that OpenOffice exists for it. And the same way with, you know, all the other open source programs you can get for it.
You see, I guess
you're not probably the target or the audience you're looking at there.
You see, my computing background is, I don't know, I'm more of the low end kind of person. You know, I started with the Commodores.
Yeah, so I did the same thing.
I have more of a blue collar mentality, I guess, when it comes to computing. You know, I've gone to the Lehigh Valley Mall, and I went to that Italian restaurant that's two doors down from mm-hmm. the Apple Store, and I just, you know, I looked in the window and I saw some of the people that are in there, and I saw, you know, different types of people. I saw some of the younger crowd in there that, you know, seemed to be into the gadget types. And there's also, like, I don't know, there seemed to be, like, a large, like, yuppie type group in there. Like, some of the older people, you know, they pull up in their Beamers.
Well, that's, I mean, there are still people, as much as I love Linux, there are still people that I would just, for ease of use, would say use the Mac. You know, go out and buy a Mac. People I work with on it, it's one of those things that, you know, I don't feel like, you know, being their system, their IT guy forever. I did the same with my parents. When it was finally time to buy a new computer, when the 300 megahertz machine had just gotten to the point where, you know, yes, it did work, and, you know, for me it worked fine on it, but for mom it didn't. So I was just like, well, here, just go out and buy this one, and you ain't got to buy another one for another 5 or 6 years, which is probably about the way average for them anyways on it. So, yeah, it was just easier. And, you know, I have never had to go down there and fix stuff for them or anything like that. So it just works for them, and I'm happy there. They're happy, I'm happy, because I haven't got to, you know, be called in the middle of your, you know, in the afternoon going, how do you make it print? You know, stuff like that. I was like, well, just plug it in, and it works. You know, so.
You talk about the ease of use on Macs, and,
well, I mean,
I don't know.
The newer versions of, you know, of, when, you know, you put a new version of Ubuntu on something now. Excuse me. On it. And, you know, yeah, pretty much everything will work perfectly on it. But on an older machine, it's just going to be that much slower. You know, when mom starts complaining about the fact that this is taking forever, it's time to upgrade. It just comes down to that.
But isn't that true for all computers, though? Like, you know, you get a machine, you know, what's the
time? Oh, yeah, but I figure for them, you know, I'm not going to have to be worrying about getting a new machine for another 5 or 6 years. And by then, yes, everything will have moved up, and, you know, it'll be worthwhile at that point. But for right now, it was just easier for me. I just don't feel like I'm at a point now in my life where I don't feel like hassling for things.
You see,
if it doesn't work, I say fuck it, and I find something that does.
The people that I've converted to Linux, you know, family members and some people I know and friends,
mm-hmm.
they seem to be okay once you get that initial install and all the hardware set up for them.
Oh,
they're okay.
I had no problem. This is going back now. This is Ubuntu 5, I think it was what I first put on mom's computer after telling them that I refused to fix Windows 98 for them once again. And I really didn't have a hell of a lot of problems. You know, I upgraded whenever, you know, it came up. You know, she would give me a call and it'd be just, okay, well, here, just do this. Let it upgrade. And, you know, it's real simple even back then to, you know, to keep it updated on it. But it just, you know, as the versions got more and more, you know, about around 7 on it, on a 300 megahertz machine, that's just like pushing it on it. And especially because it was a crappy, the gateway, I think it was. And there was pretty much nothing you could put in there that didn't fuck up something else. I mean, it was really that bad. I mean, the video card, I couldn't even find a decent video card that would fit in it. On it was all this weird shit, and it was just a pain in the ass. So,
yeah, the thing about the video card, like this weekend, I went to my brother-in-law's. Now he had he's got a Dell machine that's maybe, I don't know, two and a half years old.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad machine, you know. It's got a pretty quick processor on it, you know, maybe like 100 gig hard drive. You know, he had Windows XP on there, and he's had Verizon DSL for like maybe 9 months, and the machine is just gone to shit in the handbag. You know, when we had Windows XP on it, it just got slower and slower. He was getting these pop-ups and viruses, and it was slowing down. Like I was checking out the machine before, you know, I actually did the install for him, and it was kind of slow and not very responsive. And, you know, it doesn't help the fact that, you know, he had three kids. He's got three kids in the house, and they're going to all these different websites.
You don't even need to have kids in the house. I converted the boss's laptop over. We dual-booted it on it. It's, you know, it's a relatively new, it's one of the new Lenovo's.
T61?
T61s, yeah. Really nice machine. It's like a 3 gigahertz processor, I think, in it. I mean, it works really nice on it, with the exception, you know, it's got XP on it because, you know, that's what the company provides on it. And it just kept getting slower and slower and slower. So luckily he has admin rights to the machine on it. So we made it into a dual boot machine, and it is so freaking fast now. We, you know, put the latest version of Ubuntu on there. On it, and it is this fucking speed demon. There's no other way of putting it. And he's real happy with it. And I also turned one of his desktop machines into a Linux box. And again, he's really happy with it because he's like, well, you know, my wife does nothing more than write email and, you know, print out stuff on the computer, and everything just plugged in and worked.
Now, you talk about that, and you also talk about the Apples, and I went, you know, going back a couple months. Well,
he's also an Apple person too, so you know, he's got both.
I heard Leo Laporte's radio show podcast, you know, which is a podcast from his radio show that he does out in L.A. And
yeah, I've never listened to that.
Some old lady calls in and she's like, you know, I just want to do email and go on the internet a little bit, but you know, what kind of computer should I buy? And Leo steers her towards, you know, like a $1,200-$1,300, you know, Apple machine. And I'm thinking to myself, it's pretty basic. Yeah, that would work for her. But what about, you know, what about a Dell box with Ubuntu pre-installed? Is it that much harder to learn for someone who's new to computers? You know, is it that much?
Neither one of them are hard to learn because we converted everybody at work. Well, I should say everybody in my department is now running Linux on their machines. I mean, we went from, you know, Unix, but it was an older version of Unix. Everybody had CDE as their desktop on. So there was, you know, a brief learning curve once we first sat them down behind the machine on it, but everybody just popped right into it. I mean, it's not that hard to learn stuff. Some people are just slower than others on it, in terms of learning stuff. It's not any difference, but people go in with it with like an attitude like it is. And those are the ones who have trouble, you know, trouble learning a new system. If you go in with the attitude, my God, this is different from what I knew before. My parents, you know, I use them as an example on it. But I mean, I bought, one of the first things I bought them was one of those Windows for Dummies books, which basically gave you all of the basic, you know, how to open a program, how to close a program, how to save the program on. And 3 years later, I was still getting phone calls going, how do I save this document I made up? You know, it's just, and I don't get that. The odd thing is I don't get that anymore. So I don't know what the difference really is, because it's file save no matter what the hell you do.
Right. The basic procedure is the same no matter what OS you're running.
But for some reason, sitting her behind, you know, a Mac machine on it, I didn't have the same problem sitting behind a Linux machine. I don't know what it is. It's probably psychological somewhere. It's, you know, this is different, but this one isn't. I don't know, but it worked for her, and that's, you know. So in that case, it was the best option.
Well, my brother-in-law, you know, he went the route, you know, talking to the Dell people. And of course, you know what they do. They tell him to reinstall. He did that, you know. He got the virus, antivirus software running. They tell him to do the spyware thing. He went through all of that. And it helps for a little bit, for a short time, but then it just turns into a pile of crap after a while. It just comes to a grinding halt. So he prompted me to set him up. So I put Ubuntu on there, you know, I'm familiar with it. And I gave him, I had an Ubuntu book that I had sitting around. And I haven't heard from him, so I can only assume that he hasn't had any issues.
If you're comfortable behind a computer in the first place, I don't think you'll ever have a problem. You can swap between systems, especially, like I said, you know, the newer versions. I mean, I remember the hell of, you know, Red Hat. You know, 5 and 4, actually.
That was a long time ago, though.
But, you know, yeah, and you know, you tried to put somebody behind a computer then and said, oh, this is Linux, and they'd be looking at you going, yeah, give me back Windows. But nowadays, I mean, it's not that, you know, my wife, that's all she uses. The only time she'll go on the Mac is, like, a couple of her websites, if she wants to get the latest video on it, they're using, like, one of the later versions of Adobe. And it just doesn't play well.
Alan, get off your ass and install Flash Player 9, man. What's your problem?
It is on here, but there's just some videos that just don't play right for it. I don't know what it is. I've always had this problem with Flash on it. Some videos work really nice for me, and other ones are like, you know, they're really annoying where you have, you know, it's the words here, and then it's, you know, like that, the bad, you know, Kung Fu movies where nothing matches up. I mean, that's what it comes out in. I don't know what it is. It says it's the latest version. So for those, she goes over and she files it up. She fires up the Mac box. And then she goes back to the Linux box to go on to all the rest of her sites. So, well, and that was only because I said there is no more Windows in this house. This is what you have to learn.
Exactly. I've gone completely free of Windows in this place. And for a long time now, I've had my wife running the Linux, and she seems okay with it. Now, she's not a regular user. I mean, she's pretty technical. You know, she was in the IT industry for a long time, and she knows different platforms. But she seems pretty comfortable, and no real complaints from her. I got my 4-year-old son using it, and he's learning, you know.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not hard if that's all you're going to put on a machine. But like I said, it's just sometimes the other one works better for people. I don't have a better, you know, no official reason for it. It's psychological for some people.
The one thing that Apple has got people by the balls, it seems, is with this iTunes store, man. People, you know, they go in there and they buy music, and it's got the DRM. And then they download the podcasts, and then, you know.
Well, I use it to download podcasts on it, but I don't buy any
music. But why?
Because I have an iPod. It's just easier.
That's the only reason why.
It may not be the right way of doing it, but it's just easier for me.
Fail.
Now, what's scary is that there are a lot of people who use iTunes that download our show and the other Linux shows, too. Mm-hmm. And they insist on staying with the iTunes. There are plenty of good Linux-based pod-catching software out there.
Oh, I know.
They don't want to switch.
Well, it's not so much we don't want to switch as I'm lazy.
That's what it is, then. People are just freaking lazy.
It's because all I do is I plug it into the dock and I walk away. On it, which you still, no matter which Linux client you have on it, you still have to do the drag and drop, or, you know, start a script to do something. Where I have that, it's just, I plug it in, oh, look, it's back on again, I take it off, and it's done. Actually takes me longer to log in than it does for me to download the shit on it. I mean, because I don't do it every night either, so, you know, it's not that, you know, that many for me to do, but it's just because it's one shot.
Have you tried using some of these Linux-based applications for podcasting?
Yeah, I used Bash Potter for a long time. I actually used Bash Potter at work some. Well, I did up until they upgraded my machine to Enterprise 5.
So you can't do drag-and-drop files on an iPod?
On my older one, I could. On the newer ones, you can't.
That's crap, man. I have my iAudio. I plug the thing in. I drag the files over that I want to listen to on a given day. I unplug it, and I'm on my way.
Okay, well, you're still two steps more than me. That's the only difference of it is.
Now, Alan pays for that convenience at the sacrifice of freedom.
Oh, he doesn't care about freedom. Yeah.
I use whatever works for me, Dan, and I always have.
And I guess, you know, that's also a viewpoint of a lot of other people. One of the other arguments you hear a lot is that I use the technology that works for me. So if you have an iPod and you like the way iTunes runs and handles everything, you know, you're not going to find that same level of support for your iPod in any other environment. And except for Windows, but even then, there's way too many bugaboos using iTunes with an iPod on Windows compared to using it on Mac, from what I hear. But I can't say, I don't know. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Alan.
Well, the little MP3 player that I had, and I don't even remember what the little one.
You had an iRiver, didn't you?
An iRiver, yeah. On it. I mean, that worked fine under Linux. I had no problem with that. It was basically, again, it was drag and drop on it. But it just, you know, the iPod was just easier to use. And so I ended up using that one. It's just easier, that's all.
You see, I've never owned an iPod.
Like I said, it never bothers me. DRM doesn't bother me because I don't download music. I don't buy music like that on it. When I buy music, I buy it on a CD and I just rip it over. So it's to me, yeah, they can change it tomorrow and it's not going to bother me at all. It's all MP3s or AAC files, which actually to me sound a little bit better than MP3s, but that's just, you know, that's just a personal thing for me. I'll never lose my music from it.
Have you ever tried putting Rockbox on the iPod?
No, I haven't. I have a Generation 3 that I probably could, which actually works very well. And it only works really well because I've never upgraded it, you know, because it always ran under Linux.
Because there's a pretty good article in this month's Linux Journal about Rockbox, and it looks pretty cool. I know, Dan, you've played a little bit with Rockbox, haven't you?
Yeah. I did try it out on... No, wait. Was it Rockbox? No, I did iPod Linux a couple years ago when I had that iPod that I got.
Now, you had an old one, right? You had a first-generation one?
It was either first or second generation. You know, I will give the iPod credit on an interface that is, you know, I think almost second to none. I mean, that little scroll wheel thing, especially, like, you know, if I could find that functionality in another player, that's a big deal.
You can do that driving down the highway, and you don't really have to look real hard.
Yeah, like
whereas I could never do that with the iRiver. I mean, the iRiver was a two-handed affair in order to change stuff on it.
If you pause the iPod and then it shuts itself off after a little while of inactivity, when it comes back on, it starts right back up where it was, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that's another thing that I love my GP2X, but, you know, quite honestly, I wish it had bookmarking like that. And, you know, the joystick is cool for playing games and other things, but when you have to use that to go back and forth in a file, it doesn't have that same level of granular control that the iPod has. Now, granted, I would never buy another iPod in my life because, you know, the damn thing lasted me, what, 6 months, if that? And was just pretty much, you know, you use it until it's dead and throw it away type device.
I don't understand that with that one, because I have a third gen that's still on the original battery. And I get 10 hours out of it easily.
I guess it varies, the quality. Some people have some lemons, and they
yeah, I mean, that could be it, too, yeah.
Damn it, Alan, you're not stealing my thunder this time.
No, I'm not.
My sister went through two of them, like, within a year.
No, my niece goes through them on a regular basis. But.
And then that's up, man. You know, I've had my iAudio for like 3 years now, and the thing still works, man. You know, I use it for listening to podcasts, and it works great. It's very basic. I plug it in, drag, drop, file, simple, you know?
No, I know on my third gen, that worked with Amarok without any problem. You know, again, it was just, you know, picked it and then just told it, you know, which songs to sync over and everything. Now, I know the newer ones won't. Actually, even if you've done any upgrades on them, even on some of the older ones, they won't work. Or there's some of them do, some of them don't. I tried it. My wife had one of the minis, and that went through all the upgrades, and just all of a sudden it got one of the upgrades, and it just stopped working under Linux. You could see what was on there. You could copy it off, but damned if it would ever put any more songs back on it.
I don't know. You hear about people who have spent thousands of dollars on buying music through iTunes.
Yeah, that I don't understand, because I can't understand how people can listen to MP3s and go, oh, this sounds really great, on anything other than earbuds.
Yeah, they're pretty crappy quality.
I guess I'm old school enough to remember records and everything, and I think MP3 music sounds like shit.
Well, it's a lossy format.
But, yeah.
And then if it's recorded at a low bit rate, it's not that good.
It's good enough format is what it is.
Well, that's all it is. It's good enough. But I would never build a collection on MP3 shit. I'd rather go to the record shop and buy, you know, used CDs or, you know, even new. I don't care. But, you know, if it's something I really want to listen to.
Alan builds his collection on WAV files.
No, I wouldn't even do it for that, even though that's not lossy.
See, my only experiences using iTunes was going back so many years ago, maybe 3-4 years ago, when Pepsi was running this thing where they had, like, bottle caps with the codes on there, and they would give you free songs on iTunes, and I think I had about 10 or 12 songs that I had won from just drinking the stupid Pepsi bottles while I'm working, and I used that application that DVD John had. I forget the name of it. And at the time it worked. No, it wasn't him. It was, I forget the name of it. Anyway, it was a Linux-based program.
Off of it.
Yeah, you would interface directly with the iTunes store, pick your songs, browse the catalog, you know, preview the songs, and then buy them through that. And it wouldn't have any DRM mod. It was great.
Oh, man, what was the name of that? It started with an S, didn't it?
I tell you, Sharp Music.
That's it. That's it. And it was used with a Q, wasn't it?
Yeah, with a Q. I don't think that's worked in a few years now. That's dead.
Yeah, pretty much. And I know they went after... Didn't they go after the Hymn Project a little while ago?
Yeah, that was a way to rip the DRM off the songs.
Yeah. You know, I don't understand that, you know, to some extent. Like, Apple is so anal about using the iPod with anything other than iTunes. I mean, what is the point? 99% of the people that own an iPod are probably going to use it with iTunes the way Apple wants. The other 1% who would like to use it, you know, the way they want to use it, are going to eventually figure out a way to crack it, to use it the way they want to, and they're never going to go up to Apple and do warranty complaints about it. I mean, that's not the kind of people that are going to use it in that way. So I don't see what Apple's big beef is.
It's probably more along the lines of, you know, when they make their deals with the record companies in the movie industry on it, they're forcing them to go, you know, you have to do this DRM stuff, otherwise we're not going to deal with you. So I think it's just, you know, so they can keep their content. They have to make it as tough as possible for anybody else to be able to do anything with that stuff.
But on the flip side of that, there's no reason for it anymore. I mean, it's over. Amazon killed
it. It's over, but the contract still remains. And I'm betting you that's what it is. They can talk, you know, oh, we don't like DRM at all, but, you know, if the industry comes in and says, well, you've always had DRM on it, we don't want you to quit it, otherwise if you do, we're not going to let you have the music, or we're going to charge you more for the music this way, on it. And, you know, it's going to cut into their bottom line, so they're going to go, okay, we'll keep the DRM and keep it at 99 cents. You know.
But you know what? It makes me wonder, though, on the flip side to this. I mean, really, how many people actually care whether something's DRM'd or not?
Well, I don't think anybody, no one cares until they lose the ability to use their music again, and it gets hit in the parking, in the wallet.
But how many of those people say, God, this really sucks, and shell out the money anyhow?
Well, they probably do, but, you know, but at that point, I think if you lost several thousand dollars worth of songs for whatever reason, on it, and you know you can't get them back, well, one, you're an idiot because you didn't make backups of them on it. But the other one is you know, you're going to, I think it's going to wake you up and go, well, gee, maybe I better find another solution to this, you know.
Amazon.
Well, Amazon is
Magnitude.
Really good on it. That's another good one.
But what's that other one that we just got turned on to?
Yeah, we just got one in the mail the other day.
Yeah, there's a few really good, like, non-DRM music stores that are, like, you know, platform agnostic, codec agnostic. They offer different codecs. That's the way it should be. It should be, you know, you should be able to buy music in different formats and different compression rates at different prices. You know, this is the 21st freaking century, man. Let's get with the times, yeah.
Yeah, but the industry is not in the 21st century.
Oh, no. Yeah, they're a bunch of greedy bastards. That's the problem.
Well, they're a bunch of greedy bastards, but that's the way they're just it. They're a bunch of greedy bastards, and they're not going to change until the very last possible moment of them being able to change.
When people stop buying old music from them?
Well, it's somebody like that's going to wake them up, yeah. I mean,
it's getting there.
They're going to go kicking and screaming all the way to the end.
Give it a few more years, man.
That's probably the case. You know, the tide, I do suspect, is turning, and more people are going to wake up to that reality and enjoy, you know, DRM-free, you know, be able to use the content the way they want to. Because as it stands right now, you know, we're bucking up on all these media devices becoming commoditized. You know, operating systems becoming commoditized, computers commoditized. You know, all that. People are going to want to be able to do whatever it is they want to do and not have to go through the hassle. And they want to do it legally, too. I suspect the majority of the people...
I think the majority of people do want to do it legally, especially once they learn that they can do things like that. So the problem is you got a lot of people who don't know that they can do things. You know, it's like, oh, it's an iPod. It only works, you know, with iTunes, or, you know, this is an iRiver. That's a weird app, but doesn't it only work with, you know, a lot of people don't know that they can use it for other things.
Right. And, you know, that's just plain ignorance. I think the new generations of, and, you know, it always surprises me, though, too, when I say the new generation of kids and people growing up, you know, you'd be surprised at how many of them are clueless, too.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's always going to be that, and I think that little segment is going to continue to grow more and more and have bigger expectations. You know, they're going to want, you know, they're going to want their devices regardless of, they're not going to want an operating system. They're going to want a device that just works.
Which is why I tend to use different operating systems.
Can you use other devices with iTunes besides an iPod?
Not via iTunes. I mean,
Apple avoided getting sued as a monopoly regarding iTunes? That's what I want to know.
Because they don't have a huge market share.
They're making tons of money, man.
They're making tons of money, but they don't have that Windows desktop is what, 95% still?
Yeah, but a lot of the iTunes people are using Windows.
No, that's true too. Yeah.
I think they got brought up on monopoly charges in
the EU, right? Yeah.
In Europe somewhere. Was it France that initiated that?
I think you're right, yeah.
For not allowing other audio players besides the iTunes or the iPod to be able
that
to...
That sounds like a monopoly, man. They're controlling the hardware stack, the software stack, and the media. That sounds like a monopoly to me.
I don't know. I am not a lawyer.
Well, I think the flip side to that is the reason why I guess maybe they're not getting busted as being a monopoly is because there are other services. There are a ton of services that, from what I understand, offer, like, what is it, Rhapsody? And
yeah,
a few
Rhapsody,
others,
the subscription
DRM-protected
types.
Windows
yeah.
media files. You know, and from what I'm thinking that some of those don't work with an iPod.
No, they don't.
Well, if you have anything Windows Media, no, it won't.
No, so that works with other devices that play DRM protected Windows Media. What is it? Windows Media Audio 10? Is that the one that's all DRM protected?
That only works with their player, I think. Excuse me.
No, I know they had that in play before Zune. I think even the iRiver, when I bought the iRiver those few years ago, that it came with, like, Rhapsody or something that would allow you to download and play DRM-protected Windows Media files off of their service. If it was Rhapsody, I know, again, MP3.com was another one that would allow you to play DRM-protected MP3s mm-hmm. through your compatible device.
Has anybody bought a Zune? Is anybody using that? Do you know of anybody using a Zune?
The only time I've ever seen one is in a store.
Yeah, all right, at the Best Buy.
Yeah, I've never seen one. Anybody holding one?
Does that use its own software? I would imagine.
I think it uses Windows Media Player. If I'm not mistaken, Windows Media Player has a lot of that functionality built in. I know the MP3 player I got from my mom for Christmas at Radio Shack, it mounts as a mass storage device, but if you're using it under Vista and maybe XP, the new Windows Media Player 10 allows you to manage it as some kind of, just like iTunes with regards to your library. Be able
playlists.
To sync it back and forth. Yeah, playlists and stuff. Hmm. Of course, I've never seen it utilized that way, but it has that functionality. And again, that's based on Windows Media Player 10, if I'm not mistaken, but I've never used it.
Yeah, I don't know anybody who's actually owned one of those. The first generation got pretty crappy reviews, what I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the newer ones are supposed to be better, but still.
So they still suck, basically.
I believe so, yeah.
Well, you know,
I guess if you don't know any better, you know, it's just a player that happens to work with Windows that you're using anyways. So the same type of thing, you know, it's an iPod that works with, well, iPods work with Windows too. So I screwed that one up, sorry.
So, you know, you were talking about switching your brother over to Linux.
Brother-in-law.
And everything. Yeah, brother-in-law. Now, I went home, I saw my parents this weekend, and I got to play around on my mom's laptop, which is running Vista. And I'm actually surprised it's still running. One of the interesting things was when I plugged in her MP3 player and booted the machine up, it went into a rescue mode and said it can't boot, it couldn't boot, it needs to recover. It asked me whether I wanted to run the system restore, recover back to a previous time, it couldn't boot. So I'm like, why the hell would it be doing this? So I rebooted it instead of doing that and pulled out the MP3 player and it booted fine, which is kind of a scary thing. You know, to realize that a little device like that could totally host
your make system. It explode.
Yeah, make your system explode. But I got to use it a little bit, and I wasn't completely turned off by Vista, other than the fact that it was horrendously slow compared to, you know, like, I would fire up my Triple E PC, and in the time it took to like, I don't know, go through post on that damn thing, my Triple E PC was up in advanced mode on running Fluxbox, you know, which is, and my wife boots twice as fast because she doesn't go through all that crap. She just goes right into the easy mode. So, you know, it's a big contrast for for what my mom is doing with the computer and what we could do with the Triple E's, you know, Vista is just a pig and a half. But their Norton security system expired, and they were being pushed to either find something else or buy, you know, re-up the subscription, which I guess, you know, the brand new laptop, it lasted, what, 3 months for the security trial? If that, I don't know. It was expired by the time I got there and was looking at it. I wanted to get a desktop background switcher for my mom, you know, to put in a bunch of pictures of the kids and allow that to cycle through on her desktop. And the, one of the things that slapped me in the face as I went to go find one was, all of a sudden, I'm back in the Windows environment again. I don't know what to trust. You know, can I trust something off of Microsoft's site? Can I trust something not off of Microsoft's site? How do I know what's going to come, you know, riddled with spyware? It's a really, really horrible thing. You can't trust anything, you know, over there. It's almost like if you want to use your computer, you just throw caution to the wind and say, I'll be damned, you know. If it happens, it happens. If it blows up, it blows up. I don't think that's the right way to work a system.
That's the way they're used to working it, though. People who do that every day accept the fact that it works like crap because they don't know any better.
And that's a shame.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I mean, I set my mom up with Skype, and she has a webcam, so now we can Skype back and forth, video cam on the Triple E's to her Vista machine. And I mean, at least that is working right now.
Well, they got a DSL connection, right, Ben? Verizon,
yeah,
or something?
They have a Verizon. I think it's, yeah, Verizon DSL now. So it's the low end DSL, so it's not, you know, like I come down there from using like Work's network and my network at home, and it's like, ooh, I feel like I'm on dial-up on when I'm there with them because it's a little on the pokey side.
That's funny because my brother-in-law's Verizon DSL, I did a speed test, and he got pretty good download speeds. He was getting like 3 down and like 768 up. It was decent, you know, and in Linux it was even better.
Yeah, they have the low-end package, though, so I think they got like 1 down and 128 up or something. It's good enough for them. I mean, it's a huge difference compared to dial-up.
Oh, yeah. That goes without saying.
Yeah, dial-up really sucks. But
I think two cans and a string sometimes are just a big up from dial-up.
Now, you know, you had mentioned the emails that we got this week, and if you guys don't mind, I would like to read some of those, if that's okay.
Sure, go ahead, man.
All right, because, you know, we would really love to get your email in. We usually respond, but, you know, I think we should also maybe read some of them occasionally. You know, if you have questions for us, please do email opinions or whatever. If you want our opinion, email us. Okay, this is from Danny from Texas. He said, good job on the show. You present Linux in a way that is not boring and exciting. Now, I think he means that we present it in a way that is not boring, but we present it excitingly. Otherwise, we present it not boring or exciting. I am a sheriff deputy, and your show makes the patrol very smooth. I drive around and listen to your show.
We've been busted.
Yeah. Yes, we have. And, you know, that's always, I really love when we get an email like this from somebody who's not in the tech field.
And sure, like truckers and policemen and emergency service workers.
Right. Any, you know, if you're not in the tech field and you're using Linux, you know, traditional technology field, it'd be cool to hear from you. And even if you are in the tech field, it's still cool to hear from you. I use Linspire, and you guys need to check them out again. Click and Run is coming along very good, and it has commercial apps. Maybe you guys could give them another shot. You know, I'm on the fence about Linspire. I've never really used it. I don't overly dislike it. And I'm not drawn to using it because it's just not a distro for me. But, you know, the general impression I get is people who use it really, really like it.
It's kind of on the wane, I think. You know, they never really got what they were aiming for, you know, getting all the Windows converts. It seems is, you know, they started off in the direction as being the easy to use Linux, you know, Linux-based desktop replacement for Windows. And I think Ubuntu's kind of stepped into that to a large degree. They're kind of on the wane, Linspire. It seems like I reviewed Linspire 2.0 like, I don't know, 2-3 years ago, and it was nice for the time, you know, but they haven't kept up, you know. I really think they've been passed by. And, you know, besides the fact that some people have issues with the whole codex and everything, you know, I really think they've been left behind, you know.
Yeah, I hope, you know, there's some progress on their end.
And the thing with Click and Run, you know, the idea was very promising, but I don't think they really delivered as far as bringing in, you know, items that you can't get anywhere else, you know?
Well, I think they were supposed to do something with Ubuntu, but it kind of fell apart, and Ubuntu went their own way.
Yeah, well, all they would have to do is add another repo for commercial applications. That's it. Some kind of a mechanism where you can pay for different commercial apps through the repos, and it's pretty much Click and Run, you know.
Yes, it is. I mean, I do hope them the best. I wish they would have continued development on some of their applications, like
In Vue kind of died, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It got taken over by Composer, though.
What'd they do? They forked it.
Forking A, man.
Yeah, they did. They did fork it, but I forget what the name. I think it's Composer with a K.
Yeah, I think it is.
I'm
yeah.
Not sure. And there was L Songs too. Did that ever go anywhere?
Not really, no. It had integration with that music store, which I happened to buy music from a while back.
What was that MP3 Locker or something? Was something Kevin Carmody was?
MP3 Tunes.
MP3 Tunes, yeah. Was that DRM encumbered?
No.
All right. Well, let me finish this up, because actually that goes right into the next thing. I was reading news about the prostitute that was with the governor and how she was also a singer.
I never liked the Linux.
Yeah, I went to her site and found that her music is on a site called Amy Street, AMIE Street. Their music is DRM-free, and the prices are very cheap, from free to 99 cents. Most of the songs are from 20 cents to 37 cents, though. I checked out their stuff, and their music is pretty good. I know you guys use Magnatunes, but this is also a good site. The link for the site is Amy Streets. I think it's Amy. AMIESTREET.com. We'll just post that in the
form. So you can go buy the music from the prostitute that was with the governor, the former governor now, of New York.
And if you have Girls Gone Wild, you can see her in the in the lesbian scenes there.
There you go. A prostitute with a heart of gold.
There you go.
And a golden throat.
But I'm so innocent in all of this, though.
I'll post her link there, too, so you can get her music directly.
All right, Dan.
Woo, yeah.
I think you can get her music off of the her MySpace page. Had all her music on it too.
Is it still up? I thought I heard her MySpace page was down.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't go to it, but I remember seeing pictures of it and stuff.
We got some emails, and some people have hit me up on IRC about the fact that our last episode wasn't coming up right in some podcatchers. I think on actually speaking of the Zune, somebody had written in and said that. They got a Zune really cheap or something, and it wasn't showing up on the Zune.
Dan, you messed up the feeds again?
Yeah, I put the wrong publication date in. I still had an old publication date, which seems to mess things up. I don't know why, but it does. You got to be more careful of that, because it actually passes validation and works perfectly in Bashpotter.
So what are you saying? Bashpotter isn't up to snuff as far as high-level validation?
I guess so. It just it accepts everything. Last
garbage
email.
In, garbage out.
That's it. Last email for this week.
Going to get you, man.
Last email for this week that anyone mentioned from Greg, who said that he's been really enjoying our show, and he said at the end of the show 236, I mentioned that I was on the lookout for certain IRC clients, particularly those to run inside of a screen session through SSH. If you listen to Dave Yates' latest, a lot of Linux links, he had mentioned about this too, because we were talking about it on the IRC last week, I think it was, and we had taken a look at Rhapsody, which is an Ancursus-based IRC client. And also what this guy offers is WeChat, which runs inside a shell. Essentially, what it is in a nutshell is something like XChat provides a great way for being able to keep up with IRC on multiple channels and multiple servers. Its tabbed interface lets you know when you have somebody speaking on another channel or when somebody's speaking directly to you on another channel, which is not as apparent in IRSSI. You can see down in the lower left right-hand corner on IRSSI above the text input window when somebody has private messaged you, but you still have to keep switching around to keep on track of different conversations that you are having or going on. We wonder if that functionality could be replicated in a command line based IRC client. Rhapsody, unfortunately, while it looks a lot like XChat, does not have that tab capability, but WeChat is pretty neat in that it allows you to have multiple, you split your window in multiple ways. You can do it horizontally or vertically. So you can actually look at two different sessions going on at one time. It doesn't have tabbed capability, so to speak, but at least you can manage more than one chat a lot easier. It also has audio cues that you can implement, but I'm not sure that they would be functional across a screen session through SSH. Something to look into, but yeah, WeChat is pretty interesting and easy to install too. Speaking of Dave Yates, if you listen to his new episode, he single-handedly wiped out his boss's beautiful memories of family and children and everything when he wiped out his boss's Windows system.
Nice, Dave.
Didn't back it up, the bastard. And he was gloating about it, too. He's like, man, I walked in and I said, here's you, Ubuntu, and I didn't back anything up, so suffer the consequences, you Windows user. How do you like Linux now? And then he said, that's how I roll. And it hit his boss in the face. No, that's not how it happened.
Ruined experiences for yet another user.
Yes, I think that was my interpretation of what happened. Dave might have told it a little differently, but I think I pretty much hit it the nail on the head on that one. So don't you know, when you listen to it, take it with what Dave Yates says with a grain of salt. Pat, did you upload a song to the server?
Yes, I'm doing it right now.
Oh, okay, cool.
Hey, how's it going with the EEPC, man?
Oh, it's freaking wonderful. I love this thing. I'm on it right now. It's, you know,
have you tried some different distros on it yet?
No, actually, no, I haven't. Because, like you said, I still need to get a larger SD card that I wanted to, because I don't want to wipe this Andros out on it. The only thing I have not, I've taken a little bit of issue with is, and this is one of the other reasons why I haven't jumped to another distribution yet, is I like the webcam on here, and from what I understand, getting the webcam to function properly in Ubuntu is a little difficult. The drivers are available, the modules for it are available, but it's just a little on the tricky side. That aside, I've been, if you've seen my Tumblr blog at possum.tumblr.com, I do like a daily update at work, and it's just some picture that I've gimped up ridiculously, and have a fun time doing it. But
you'll have to post that link there, Dan.
I'll post it right now. Anyway, It's possum.tumblr, T-U-M-B-L-R.com. That's possum with no O, just P-O-S-S-U-M.tumblr.com. Anyway, I make use of a program on here called UC View to take the pictures off the with the camera, and it doesn't have like a timer that it would, you could set it to say, you know, in 10 seconds, snap the picture, which is unfortunate. And I think maybe I can hack it to do that if I could pull down the sources. So I looked into a bunch of other applications that are available in the Zandros repository, and none of the other ones that would allow me to delay the picture-taking capability of the camera work with Video for Linux 2, which sucks. The only one that does is Ikiga, and Ikiga doesn't allow me to take the snapshots like UC View does. So that's the only downside. Now, I've gotten around that a little bit by using K snapshot or whatever it is to take a picture of the desktop. So I put, you know, I start that up on another virtual desktop, set it for like 15 seconds, go back
and
over,
you
pull
have
the camera
entirely too much time on your hands here.
Yeah. Oh, are you looking at it right now?
Yeah. You have entirely too much time on your hands.
Yeah, that's what my wife says. But, yeah, it's a little difficult to read that as sometimes.
I'm going to have
Tumblr's
to toss that in my blog lines feed.
Yeah, so you got to read it from, like, you got to read it backwards. But then when you come to a day, you got to read it from the top down, but you read it from backwards top down. Yeah, you would read, like, March 7th top down, then March 8th top down, except for the one with the carrot. You'd read that bottom up before I learned how I should do it top down. But then some of them don't make sense because I post something and then later on I post a follow up to it and it's, you'll see. I don't know. It's just stupid stuff. Dave Yates wouldn't like it because it's social networking and Dave Yates doesn't like social networking.
Dan, you talk a lot about Dave Yates, man. Are you, like, stalking him or something?
I was, but he deleted his Twitter account. So now I'm having a harder time stalking him.
You need to know what Dave is up to at all times of the day.
What's Dave? What? I have a bumper sticker that says WWDD. What would Dave do?
What would Dave do if he was one of us?
We need to
He'd
get stickers made up for
memories.
That. For when we go out to Ohio Linux Fest, we need stickers that say that. What would Dave do?
Rumor on the street has it that the real reason why Linux Reality is closing, Chess is closing up, is because Dave Yates threatened him. He said that... that no more. He said, I'm going to come down there. If you do another podcast, I'm going to run you over with my Honda Civic. Shout out to the Linux Outlaw guys. I don't know. I'm getting it right now.
Yeah, those guys are cool, man. Fab and Dan. They have a great show. I enjoy it a lot.
What's Dave Yates doing right now? .com.
They're funny guys, those two.
Yeah, what else?
Dan, that's a new website for you to create. Right. What's Dave Yates doing now.com.
You already got it registered. It's up already.
You can go to his website and you can see his webcam that never changes.
It's like a picture from like 6 years ago of him, right?
Probably. He was going off on his latest podcast about his wife being frugal. You know what the truth is.
A man shouldn't complain about a woman like that, not for nothing. You should consider yourself blessed if you have a woman that doesn't go out and spend.
Yeah, Lord knows, I don't know how to stop spending.
I'm pretty lucky, man. My wife is pretty frugal, though.
He was probably like, look, woman, I'm going to go and I'm going to get me an Apple AirBook, whether you like it or not. And she said, but Dave, we're going on vacation. Consider your family. And that's what the reality was. He wasn't going to buy a Triple E. It was an AirBook he wanted. and he went to go order
Mac
it.
Mac Air Biscuit?
Yeah, Mac Air Biscuit. He went to go order it, but he was using Vista at the time, and it, Windows Internet Explorer crashed during his ordering process, and he got too frustrated. That's the real truth, but he doesn't want to admit it on his show. Are we listening to Warp 11?
Yes, we are.
Yes.
Suds me up, Sulu.
What is that?
Next week we're talking to Bruce Perens.
Really?
Yes. The last time we talked to Bruce was at Linux World Expo in 2006. So it should be
Boston,
interesting to hear from him. Yeah, in Boston. So it should be cool to talk to him. It's been a while. And then the week after that, I got someone from Zimbra, which is a pretty cool email suite. And I also got Ian Murdoch lined up for April.
Cool.
From that Debian project.
No, he's with Sun Microsystems now, Dan.
Well, wasn't he the founder of Debian?
Yes, he was, Debian.
Debian, right?
Debian.
Debian.
Well, it's Deb, his wife Deb, and Ian. Debian.
Yes, I know. We need a project called Alan. Alanware.
So what, it would be quiet all the time?
Yeah.
Alan said quite a bit today.
It would be quiet during interviews.
He was all chatty catty, man, today.
Yeah, every once in a while. Alright, play us out.
Alright, here we go. Here we go.
Good night, everybody.
We'll
see you next week.
Love to you. Love
Have
to
a good
you
one.
All.
The bridge, and you've got the helm. Hot water burning, overwhelms, and you've got control of the shower head. So lather me up, baby. Warp speed ahead, come on and suds, suds, suds me up soon. Come on and suds, suds, suds me up, Sulu. I feel so dirty, covered in grunge. Go get the captain's toupee, I need a sponge. 'Cause you've had a long day now, and I smell your rain. So let's scrub ourselves, pick and span, baby, and give each other a spank. Come on and suds, suds, suds me up, Sulu. No one else on this filthy ship can stay on course like you do. Come on and suds, suds, suds me up, Sulu. No one else can navigate a wormhole as clean. Start at my head, move to my feet. You can be the admiral, baby, and I'll be your fleet. Rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Mm, yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.
It's over.
It's over, Johnny. So, Alan, you going to go upgrade your Mac?
Am I upgrading it to what?
The latest OS.
Not unless I find out I have to.
Okay.
Or somebody gives me one, or somebody gives me a copy for free.
I'll make you a copy for free, Alan. What do you want? CentOS? Slackware?
Got all those.
There we go.
Matter of fact, I got to dig up an old hard drive and put Slack 12 onto it and try it out on my desktop machine. I got to see if I can get the NVIDIA drivers working right on it and just see if it's something in my Ubuntu setup or if it's just the card is sucks. I figure there's nothing more vanilla than Slack to put on there.
Who was it that we talked to tonight? Besides,
besides Peter?
Yeah, what's the other guy's name?
He was their publicist guy. PR guy.
Who?
I'll tell you in a sec. Rashad.
Is that who we talked to mainly?
No, we talked to Peter.
Peter.
Oh, okay.
Peter Semelhack.
Did the other guy really didn't talk at all yet, did he?
A little bit. He said like one thing during the interview.
All right.
I think I get going, guys.
Have a good night, Alan.
We'll talk to y'all later.
Bye. Hey, what happened to Link tonight?
He got sick.
Did I?
Right before you came on, he was on and said that he wasn't going to be able to make it today.
That sucks.
Got the HIV. He had a HIV headache. That's the way it goes.
So did you go vote in the forum?
Vote for what?
What we should do with the Apple people in the Linux community.
Oh, no, I didn't see that was there yet. I didn't spend too much time on the forum today.
Yes. Go to the forum and vote. Should we call out the Apple lovers amongst our ranks?
I will do that. I will go vote. And I will also make sure that I put in the right publication date for the show.
That would be a good thing, Dan.
This is 237. On the 19th.
Of March.
On the 19th. Yep. And we're pretty much good and ready to go. Yeah. All right. Awesome.
Excellent.
Stuff. Good stuff tonight, Pat. I really like those Debug Lab stuff. If only I had the money to afford it.
I know. I hear you, man. I really want a new laptop, man, but I really don't have the cash to get one. My money situation's pretty tight right now.